Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Welcome, 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 everyone. My name is Neeraj Chaudhry. I'm an investment consultant with the Los Angeles branch of Euro Pacific Capital. Joining me, I'm sitting in for Peter Schiff today. Joining us in about 30 minutes will be Peter Schiff. He is currently in a meeting, but he told me that he will be joining us at the bottom of the hour, and he asked me to start the show for him. We've had yet another amazing week, and I'm joined now also by my branch manager, Hemanth Kasturia, my friend, good friend of Peter Schiff's. For a quarter of a century, Hemanth and Peter were college roommates back at UC Berkeley in the late 80s. And Hemanth and I have been good friends. We've kind of all known each other for a great, a long period of time. And it is my sincere pleasure to be hosting the show with him today. He'll be joining us a bit later as well. Well, yet another amazing week this week. You know, it's every week there seems to be something new coming up. I think we live, as the Chinese say, we live in interesting times, and we are living in those times more so today than ever before. The interesting thing to me this week was the bailout of the Greeks. The Greeks have now received a multi-billion euro aid package from their Eurozone brethren, plus the International Monetary Fund. To me, this is a real problematic sign, because it shows me that governments around the world continue to do the wrong thing. And if you think that this bailout of the Greeks is going to be the last bailout, forget about it. All these guys have done in Europe is open the door now to a huge flood of requests for more aid. Portugal is right behind. Spain is right behind. Ireland is right behind. Italy is right behind. The Irish actually are trying to do the right thing, but hey, why should they? Why not just spend yourself into oblivion and then say, oh, we can't do it all out? The interesting party here is really the Germans. Angela Merkel, Chancellor Angela Merkel, really had no intention of participating in any kind of bailout and was really pushing the Greeks onto the IMF. And I think that in the end, she blinked. It may cost her her office, her political office. She is certainly going to face the wrath of the German voters. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I think that really governments around the world are simply demonstrating the fact that they don't care what their people think. They're just going to spend, spend, spend. And we're the worst practitioners of it, even though it's hitting Greece right now. The Eurozone, it remains to be seen. This, if anything, this could put an upward lift on the euro, because people have been assuming that, you know, there's an imminent breakup of the Eurozone. I don't think that that's going to take place, but it's just amazing how these companies, these countries continue to spend and spend and spend like there's no tomorrow. What's even more amazing, which is really shocking to me, is how the markets have rallied after the Greek bailout. You know, there was a time in this country, in the world really, when economic growth was the driver for markets. at this point, it seems like politics has become the driver for markets. If you're going to get a bailout, then the markets are going to go up. Nobody seems to realize that the public sector does not create any value. All the public sector can do is take money from one group of people and give it inefficiently to another group of people. And in doing so, it distorts the market. It removes incentives for free market investment and for labor to come to the table and provide its input into the economy. All it does is distort the economy. Minimum wage, the minimum wage is responsible for the loss of jobs. Increased taxation is responsible for the loss of jobs. Increased regulation is responsible for the loss of jobs. And nobody seems to get it. But in any event, all we can do is point these things out and stick to our guns and stick to our investment strategies and hope that in the end cooler heads will prevail, although I'm sorry to say the outlook is not positive. We have a number of callers that are ringing up the lines at this point. I do want to give out the number to call in. The phone number is 888-678-9597 if you want to participate in the show. If you already have a Europac account, that's fantastic. If you want to speak with your broker, you can call 800-727-7922. If your broker is on the East Coast of the United States, you'll have to call tomorrow morning. If you are looking to open a Euro-Pacific account, we'd love to have you call. Again, you can call the 800 number now, 800-727-7922. You can also call the Los Angeles branch directly at 310-826-2975. We do have brokers in the office right now. It's about 5 o'clock Pacific time that will be they'll be glad to assist you. And it's really a remarkable thing because at the same time that Europe took a big step backwards by giving the Greeks another bailout, there is increased pressure on the Chinese to revalue their yuan higher. In fact, for those of you who watch the currency markets closely, Singapore decided overnight to revalue their curve higher. And why are their currency higher? And why did they do that? They did it to stop inflation. You have to remember the way that these countries keep their currencies pegged to the dollar is by inflating their currencies. We're going mad with inflation, and they've got to keep up. This is the worst possible thing. They're effectively stealing purchasing power away from their citizens by maintaining these dollar pegs. And one by one, these Asian countries are starting to get the message. Forget about the pressure that the rest of the world is putting on China. Singapore went out and jumped ahead of the pack and said, look, this is the right thing to do. We don't want all this inflation. You know, it used to be that that we used to export some nice goods and services to the rest of the world. Now we export inflation. And the Singaporeans have come out last night and said, no more. We're not going to be accepting your inflation. We're going to allow our currency to appreciate to reflect the dynamism and the strength of our economy. The Chinese, within the past couple of days, announced double-digit economic growth. I think that it's really just a psychological constraint that is keeping them pegged to the dollar. Well, you know, this might be the catalyst with Singapore coming out ahead of the pack and saying, look, we're going to revalue higher. Maybe the Chinese will be emboldened. I certainly hope so. I think it's the right thing to do for the Chinese people, and I think it's the right thing to do for the world economy. Forget about the outside pressures on the Chinese. They need to revalue their currency higher because the alternative, maintaining this peg, is effectively importing inflation from the United States. And believe me, they don't want it. They don't need the inflation. They don't want it. And they're going to be much better off when they allow their currencies to move higher in conjunction with the underlying strength of their economies. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Nick in California. You've been very patient and holding on. Welcome to the show. You're on the air on Wall Street Unspun with Neeraj Chaudhry sitting in for Peter Schiff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. How are you? Where are you in California, Nick?
I'm actually just north of the Bay Area. I'm in Sonoma County.
Oh, nice. I used to live in the Napa Valley. So good to hear from you.
Oh, awesome. What can we do for you? Well, you know, this is a question. Maybe it would have been better directed towards Peter, but you know, I think you guys are pretty well aligned. You know, if we get him into Senate, which I think overall will be a really substantial help to our economy, if he's able to, you know, champion a lot of deregulation and just crack down on a lot of the regulatory bodies that are basically consuming a lot of our resources and allocating them out the wrong way. We have to also, you know, talk about where government does good, because, you know, a lot of the time it's just the good intentions going to the wrong places. And
that's the key. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. I mean, governments start out with idealism, and they start out with things that sound reasonable, like, hey, let's help people. You know, people who are old and people who don't have enough money. You know, we want to have a humane society. We want to be respectful to our older people. You know, let's provide, if they don't have any money, let's provide them a small income so that they don't starve. I mean, I don't think anybody wants to see a senior citizen at the end of his life be infirmed and be homeless or at risk. And so the idea of Social Security was born, which, you know, to a small extent, if people really have no other means and they're elderly or they're infirmed, you know, you can make the argument that maybe that's the right thing to do. The problem is that when these programs are initially set up, they're very small. But each program creates in its own right a constituency, and as soon as that constituency latches on to the public dole, it doesn't want to let go. And really, other people say, hey, you know, that's a pretty good program, that Social Security program. Maybe we should expand it. And so every couple years you expand that program, and soon before you know it, you end up with, $100 trillion of unfunded liabilities. So you're right. You know, idealism is nice. It's nice to try and help people. You know, it should be done through the private sector. If there's a very small Social Security program for people who are genuinely in need, I mean, maybe, you know, I still think it should be done in the private sector, but we can at least have that debate. The problem is once you start a government program, it gets out of control.
Right, but you know, stepping even further back at the bigger picture of things, I want to talk about the way government interacts in creating regulations that make our footprint less impactful on our environment. I mean, you want to talk mm-hmm. about where all of our jobs are going? They're all going to China, but it's not necessarily just because they don't have the same minimum wage laws that we do, or the same labor unions that we do. They also don't have a lot of regulations that manufacturers have to abide by, so that they're not tearing up the environment around them. I mean, you want to go to Beijing, that place is like a dust bowl. All around Beijing, in the countryside, dust is just coming in, and it's almost the place is almost unlivable. And that's because they don't have the same regulations. They can.
Right.
It's almost a free for all. They can do whatever they want. They can, you know.
The
benefit
the
that we see, you know, we don't have the same amount of acid rain going on in Pennsylvania now because they said, you know what, we need to put up some emission standards. I mean, I just think that the incentive there, the incentive to not make as much pollution, just doesn't really exist for a business. And you want to talk about like TR. TR started our national parks program, and I don't see where there's a place for that in a free market having parks. I mean, if you give me 100 square miles of Brazil, you know, you could make a little bit of money using it as a tourist attraction for so long, but something happens down the road where I need to come up with more capital. Maybe I'll just log a portion of the park. To come up with that capital so that I could keep doing the park services, the tourist attraction.
But why is that bad? I mean, if you have a natural resource that can be used in the free market and it can be done, you know, there are a lot of companies out there that preach environmental responsibility. They make it part of their corporate pitch. And so if the market, the best arbiter of these kinds of issues is really the free market. I mean, it may be on an occasional basis, there's a case where you can say, well, you know, you want it, there's something very, very valuable, there's a specific resource that you need to protect, you know, for whatever reason, and maybe you might be able to make the case that that you want to protect that resource. But the problem there is that usually people use things like national security and say, well, I want to protect the supplies of uranium for national security purposes. And, you know, that might sound reasonable. But, again, just like with the Social Security Administration, you end up with more and more people that say, well, you know what, I'm in the telephone business. Telephones are also part of the national security infrastructure, and so we need to protect the telephone industry. And then you expand that and you say, well, I make calculators. Calculators are really part of the national security industry. And soon before you know it, everybody's lounging at the trough of national security and saying, well, I need protection because of this. I need protection because of that. You cannot continue to protect people that are not going to be bound by the covenant of the free market. The free market really is the best arbiter of private, voluntary, non-coerced exchanges of value. Let's go to Johnny in Connecticut. You've been waiting very patiently. Thank you so much, and welcome to the show.
Hi there. I had a question about investing in the precious metals through the mints and also through ETFs.
Sure.
Have you heard about any problems with the ETFs possibly not holding the actual metals that they assign certificates for?
You know, from time to time, we always hear, that is GLD backed up by real gold? And, you know, there was that whole flap a couple weeks ago in London where there was a trader, I'm not going to use his name, but there was a trader who alleged that there was massive fraud. And I did look into that somewhat, and it's very hard to demonstrate that because I think the gentleman possibly deliberately was mischaracterizing what a futures contract is for delivery versus a commitment for simply trading. So it's very hard to know, what's really going on. But it seems like it's a pretty well regulated industry as far as a self regulated market back there, and I think it's probably a very reasonable. Reasonable assumption to assume that it is there. We, of course, invest through the Perth Mint in Australia. We think that that is an outstanding operation. They've been in business for over 100 years. They've never failed to keep their commitments to their investors. That 110 or 120 years includes both World Wars and the Great Depression. Of course, all investments may not be suitable for you, and you should check with either your Europac, a financial advisor, or your own financial advisor to determine risks and risk tolerance and suitability and time horizon, things like that. But no, we think that the Perth Mint has been around for over 100 years, and we feel very confident about that institution.
The program through the Perth Mint, is that similar to how some banks operated in the 1800s where people – hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I heard something in the background. Is that similar to how banks operate in the 1800s, where depositors would put in, say, their silver possessions or coins, and then they would get a bearer note, essentially, a note from the bank, in which case any bearer that shows up with that note would be able to claim that certain amount of silver?
No, the Perth Mint is... very, very rigid about security. They require extensive documentation, extensive IDs, signatures, notaries, things like that. So, you know, they're very, very mindful of security. It is not a case where you've got a Perth Mint certificate and somebody else can pick up that certificate and cash it in. That's not the case. They're very mindful of security. So if that's your concern, I think I'd put that one to rest.
Okay, whether you were using allocated or unallocated shares or allocated or unallocated metals.
Correct. You get a certificate in your name that has your specific information on it, and only through your signature can that be redeemed. You can do it through our Perth Mint team or through your Europac broker, but only through your signature, and that signature is verified, will they accept a redemption of that certificate.
Okay.
So it's a pretty well-run program, very focused on security, very long-term program, over 100 years, and we feel very confident in that program.
Could I ask a question of you about China?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, I don't want to take up too much more, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, there's some suspicion around that China may be in a bubble, whether it's temporary or not. I mean, some of the aspects of China may be rapidly rising property prices, as well as rampant credit growth in that area. Certainly, China's always had a certain level of corruption, debatable whether we're seeing a surge in it. And the Chinese have a certain amount of faith in the competence of their authorities. That may be changing. But, you know, all of these things, and certainly the moral hazard that, the belief in that their government will not let anything happen as far as, like, allowing the bubble to pop. Do you see that those as signs of a potential bubble in China?
You know, Peter just got back from China, from the Halter Conference. I would prefer that that he address that directly, because he was just on the ground there and he got an opportunity to speak with a lot of different business leaders and a lot of different companies in China. So I think he's probably the better person to answer that, having firsthand experience over there. But I think what we can say reasonably is that, you know, the Chinese are going to make bad economic decisions. There's no doubt that if you subsidize something, if you're a government agency or a government entity and you subsidize something, you're going to get more of it. You're going to distort the market. So to that extent, I think you are going to see the Chinese, potentially make bad economic decisions. But in the long run, they are making mostly good economic decisions that are based on economic fundamentals. There's a tremendous amount of investment going on in that country. Yeah, there are going to be occasional situations where, you know, one sector or another ends up in a bubble, or one sector ends up overvalued, one sector ends up undervalued. All of that's going to take place. But the fundamental engine of the Chinese economy is savings and production, and there is just no sign that that is abating whatsoever. At this point, I'd like to welcome my branch manager and Hemanth Kathuria, who is a close friend and associate of Peter's for 25 years. He is also my good friend and my boss, so unfortunately I have to listen to him. Well, Hemanth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for that introduction. I apologize for not being able to make it at the introduction when you came on. Thanks for doing a good job, as always.
Certainly.
I was speaking just a few minutes ago to Peter. He is going to try to get on the show in about 15 or 20 minutes. He is going to be on his cell phone, so it's tough. He says the amount of stops he's having to make for the campaign are actually picking up quite a bit. So next week's show, it's good and it's bad. I mean, it's great for the campaign. It's good to get the word out as far as doing the show. He'd like to be able to do the show as well, but, you know, you can't be everywhere at once. So luckily he's got us to step in and speak on his behalf. I believe there were quite a few of the listeners from last week's show who sent in positive feedback, so that's good. To the listeners out there, keep it coming. Keep the calls coming in. We really like it. We really appreciate it. We want to be able to give you the up-to-date info on what's coming up with the firm. And just in general, the markets tend to keep trending up here. I was looking at a chart of the S&P just now, and it's
amazing, isn't it?
Quite extended. I mean, you're looking at potentially a rising wedge here. We'll see what happens. I mean, the put-call ratio, the options market shows no fear whatsoever. You look at the investors' intelligence reports as far as the percentage of bullishness. That's also in danger zone. Right now, none of it seems to matter. The market continues higher. We'll see what happens. I mean, on a price-to-earnings basis, the U.S. market certainly seems expensive. On the good news is that some of the overseas markets are still reasonably valued. We're able to buy a lot of stocks that are still in single-digit PEs. In fact, a portfolio for a client just a few minutes ago, and it's amazing that on a going-forward basis, a lot of these stocks still have that PEG ratio, which is below one. Now, for the listener who doesn't know what a PEG ratio is, that is simply the price-to-earnings ratio over the growth rate. So if the stock is trading at a PE of 10, yet it's growing at 20%, that stock would have a PEG ratio of 0.5, and that is considered very cheap. Well, we have a lot of those stocks on our recommended list at Euro Pacific Capital. Those kind of stocks are within our portfolios. Investors who have been with us have seen that that deep value style of investing does pay off in the long term. It doesn't do anything to mitigate day-to-day volatility, but the reason that we look out there and we find these values is simply because they are overlooked, and they overlooked ideas tend to be more volatile in the very short term. But that's okay if they're a small part of your portfolio. You don't need a bunch of stocks that have those kind of outsized returns. One or two in a portfolio mixed in with a lot of the utilities and the fixed income and the other kind of things, that can really add that special spice to the portfolio and make it get equity-like returns, even though a chunk of it might be in fixed income. So there's still a lot of good value in the overseas
markets. And, Heyman, just to clarify, you're talking about foreign fixed income, right? You're talking about foreign sovereign debt, supranationals, foreign convertible bonds.
Absolutely. I mean, that kind of stuff has rallied tremendously also. But if you look at it, look at the country of Singapore, for example. The bond market there is not as deep as we'd like, but it's getting, it's developing rapidly. I mean, they just revalued the currency the other day, another 1.5% up. So that's very helpful to the clients who own some of the stocks that we own in Singapore. And
absolutely,
now we've seen that the actual Singapore economy has been expanding quite a bit. You've got the Singapore Banking Center, which has surpassed Switzerland now. So it's money is continuing to flow where it's treated best, and that is what we focus on here at Euro Pacific Capital. We'll continue to find those ideas within these countries that are doing well, and it's something that is an ongoing process. So the analysts keep on bringing us these ideas, and we'll continue to do so.
Yeah,
speaking of
Singapore's GDP, you know, while we are infusing our economy with massive heroin in the form of short-term government stimulus, which will fade away very quickly, the Singaporean economy in the first quarter of 2010 grew at an amazing 13.1%. So This is the amazing thing that people don't realize. Same thing with China. China grew at a mere 11.9% in the first quarter. So it's extraordinary to see those kinds of growth rates that we would be desperate to see without government stimulus. We would desperate to see one-tenth of that in the United States. We'd probably be collapsing in the United States.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the markets overseas have growth rates that are literally knock your socks off, and the exposure to that, luckily, is just growing for us. So we've been adding more names onto the recommended list. We've got new offerings continuously coming up, and so it's something. If you're a current client of ours, be in touch with your broker. Your broker probably is reaching out to you on a regular basis, at least every 3 or 4 months, with new ideas. I mean, your money market balance is always growing because the focus of the way we invest is on the dividend. So there's usually something that can go into that's new. And if you're not a client, I'm going to say this. I say it every show, so I might as well repeat it as forcefully as I can. You got to pick up the phone and do it. You got to call call the LA branch if you're listening right now in the on the West Coast, 310-826-2975. Otherwise, you can call the toll-free line, which is 800-727-7922. You may get somebody in one of the offices other than L.A. that pick it up, so just tell them what state you're in, and they'll direct you to the proper office. Neeraj, do we have any callers on hold?
Yes, let's go to Eric in New York. You're on the air with Neeraj Chaudhary and Hemanth Kothuria on Wall Street Unspun. Welcome.
Hello. Do you guys know who Jim Chanos is?
Of course.
Okay. Lately, he's been preaching that China is in a property bubble and of the worst kind. He even called it a treadmill to hell.
I heard that.
Yes. Given his credentials, how do you see China's property? Do you think it's in a bubble?
Well, you know, Jim Chanos is a very smart guy, but there are a lot of very smart people who did not see a lot of the developments that Peter saw. You have to remember, Peter's the guy who, back in 05, 06, 07, was calling the top of the real estate market, the top of the U.S. equity market. He's been calling for gold to go to par with the Dow. He's been calling for oil to exceed its $147 price from 2008. So, you know, you've got to look at the track record of people and say, okay, who is the guy who's making the calls and what is his track record and what does he think going forward?
I think it's also important to look at who's got their own skin in the game, who's got their own money invested. And that's where you're going to find a huge difference with not only Peter Schiff, but most of the branch managers and brokers at Europe Pacific Capital. We're already invested in the kind of ideas. So you can be damn sure that we are looking carefully at what we put our money into. And it's just not being thrown on the roulette wheel. This is money that is hard-earned, and we want to see it grow in a reasonable fashion with always an eye towards risk.
No doubt. I mean, I don't doubt Peter's credentials. I think he's one of the smartest guys out there. But he hardly ever comments on China's property market. I only hear him talk about the stock market, and I don't necessarily disagree with him about that. But it's awfully. It'd be hard to think that. Gee whiz, if China's property market were in a bubble. And it popped, given all that, all those malinvestments, that it wouldn't affect China's stock market, and even then, the stock markets of the Asian region there.
Well, it's true that the overall market is going to be affected by any sector.
Look at the U.S. housing market, for instance. I mean, look how much damage that one did just by when it popped. So much around it also fell. Not to say that it wasn't a house of cards to begin with, but it's not contained. And this is my fear in investing further into the Chinese stock market.
Sure.
Are you currently invested overseas?
I'm a Europac client.
Oh, terrific, good. Well, if you're a Europac client, I would suggest that you talk to your Europac broker and make sure that that whatever your concerns are, that you've communicated your risk tolerance to your broker. Because quite honestly, there are things that if you feel scared at night by holding your Europac investments, you're probably not a suitable client for Euro Pacific Capital. Our firm is really focused on people who look at the strength and the dynamism of the Chinese economy and say, we want to be a part of that. And, you know, if there are individual concerns that you have about individual equities or individual sectors, I think we spent quite a bit of time discussing this, with the previous caller who was worried about a Chinese bubble. It's not necessarily suitable for all investors to be invested overseas. We have the boots on the ground. We've got the analysts that are on the ground looking at these companies, looking for good, solid companies that we believe have a potential to provide good returns to investors. And you know, we look at companies that are richly valued, and we typically, you'll see our analysts share their concerns about prices. So I think valuation is always a concern. I don't think you ever want to just jump in blindly. But if you have a good, solid, well-diversified portfolio that includes Asia, that includes the resource countries, that's even balanced very, very selectively with a couple of opportunities in Europe, typically outside the Eurozone, you're going to see some very good, strong, long-term, well-adjusted returns that you are not going to achieve in the United States. All the problems that the Chinese may or may not have in their real estate market are not certain. The problems in the United States are very clear with the unfunded liabilities and the lack of savings. You've got to remember that the Chinese have a double-digit savings rate. The savings rate in the United States, believe it or not, actually went down. It had been trending higher. It got all the way up to almost 5% of income. That's back down. The most recent data that I've seen, it's back down to 3.1%. So you've got to take everything into account and look at the big picture and ask yourself, would I rather be in an economy where they're growing at 11.9% a year and they've got huge savings and huge investing, and they can build things at one-third the cost or a quarter of the cost because they don't have ridiculous regulations that they've got to go through? Or would you rather invest in the United States where you've got $100 trillion worth of unfunded liabilities, nobody's saving a nickel, and taxes are only going to be going higher, regulations are going to be going higher with our friends in the Democratic Congress? You've got to make that decision for yourself. No one can make it for you. But in our view, if you have a good, solid team, if you've got a good broker at Europac, you've got good analysts, you've got Peter kind of watching from the macro perspective, you've got the capital markets guys out there on the ground looking for good opportunities that are that have good, solid valuations, we feel pretty good about that approach. And certainly there are going to be mistakes and hiccups along the way. No one bats a thousand. Nobody's perfect, but we've been pretty successful so far, and we look forward to continued success in the future. Let's go to Desmond in California. Welcome to the show. You are on Wall Street Unspun with Neeraj Chaudhry and Hemant Kathuria.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing? Where are you in California?
I'm actually calling from New York. I'm not sure how they got California, but
the board may have mixed up a little bit. No worries.
What can we
do for you this evening?
So I'm calling with a question about physical gold. So Euro Pacific Capital and Peter Schiff himself clearly advocate holding physical gold, given that the possibility of entering into an inflationary environment of the monetary supply. And I understand the reason for doing that in order to want to maintain purchasing power if the currency were to become devalued in an inflationary environment. However, Peter also seems to advocate holding physical gold in order to actually profit in this inflationary environment and to be able to increase purchasing power, because he seems to feel that consumer prices won't necessarily be rising as quickly as the dollar itself would be getting devalued and therefore increasing the value of the gold itself. I was just wondering if you could explain that to me a little bit further. I'm not quite clear on how holding physical gold would actually allow you to profit in addition to maintaining purchasing power.
Yeah, Neeraj, I think I could take
please.
That one. I mean, you've got
please go ahead.
You take all the gold that's ever come out of the earth. 5,000 years of recorded history, and what do you have? You have literally two Olympic-sized swimming pools, 6 foot deep. That's how precious it is. You're talking about a supply that can only be increased by 1.5% a year. Another way to look at it would be that gold would fit in a 23-by-23-meter cube, literally, sitting on the outfield here of Dodger Stadium. That's how precious it is. Now, the supply of dollars that you referred to, initially you said the possibility of inflation due to the money supply going up. Well, the inflation is baked into the cake because the money supply has been increasing. The factors that don't make a straight correlation between the gold price and the money supply are very numerous. One of the previous callers mentioned the various investigations going on with the CFTC and JP Morgan, HSBC, et cetera, on the futures markets and how they can affect prices on a day-to-day basis. That is one of the factors, but you've also got the Washington Agreement, which has central banks selling 500 tons a year of physical gold into the market. You got the IMF, which had 400 tons, and now half of that has already gone to India, so you could say it's moved into stronger hands, and the other half is probably also going to go to India. And then you've got China, which is now, we know now that for the last 5 years they've been taking a lot of physical gold from domestic mines and putting it into reserves, and that process is only accelerating. So you've got a lot of the various factors which have been mitigating the price increase of gold with respect to dollars, and those factors are going to become less and less prevalent because, let's face facts, it's been used. It's not available to further slow the increase, the trajectory of this gold bull market. One of the reasons that we say that you need to get in now is because this is an 18 to 20 year cycle. The moves typically will be the largest in the last 5 to 7 years of that cycle. Now, how can you profit financially separately from buying the physical gold? Well, that's if you're buying some of the good gold mining shares. They have leverage to the gold price. The low-cost producers have already had a tremendous move, but you still got the mid-cost and high-cost producers, which will only now be getting leverage. So something, you're pulling gold out of the ground at $600 or $650 an ounce, you may not have moved in your stock price yet because gold is, although it's been moving up, it's still only around 11 to 50. Now, when we take out the high at 1230, 1240, and we launch onto the next leg of this bull run, you're going to see those higher cost producers, their stocks are going to take off like a rocket. And so you can either buy the stocks or you can, you know, do it the safer way. You can buy the convertible debentures, which trade on those same shares and have less volatility. Either way you play it, there is going to be a way to profit from the move up in gold without actually acquiring the physical gold. The physical gold is your first stop. That's the foundation. That's what you need to have. But after you acquire that, certainly you can move on to the next phase, which is buying those mining shares or buying those convertible bonds or buying the different types of vehicles which will benefit an investor in an environment where the inflation is finally starting to really be reflected in the price of gold. I mean, there will be a point where the IMF has gotten rid of that last 200 tons. There'll be a point where the Chinese are accelerating their movement into reserves from their domestic mines. I mean, it's no coincidence that on Chinese state-run TV, they're advising their citizens to go to the bank and buy silver, you know, buy something. Right. But they call it the poor man's gold. It's just easier for an average Chinese citizen to get their arms around it. That's not a huge purchase, but it is a purchase. And it is something that even today, if you want to go to any bank in China, you can buy gold at about 4% to 5% over spot. Now, silver also is sold in some of these banks. The premium is higher on silver, but it is available. And so that's really the situation. The next phase
is that the only way to actually beat out the inflation then is to be investing in shares of mining companies or other leveraged options that are directly related to the price of gold? Or will owning the physical bullion itself actually allow you to beat out the inflation? Or will the physical bullion simply just maintain purchasing power in an inflationary environment?
Yeah, my feeling is you shouldn't even look at as physical bullion as having to beat anything. Physical bullion is just currency. It's just the ultimate form of currency, which cannot be expanded. The supply can only go up by that 1-1.5% a year, so you have to look at it that way. And then as far as an investment, that's where you look at the different kind of other products, like the mining stocks. And the physical is just more of an insurance policy. It's just a way that you have an anchor of the ultimate form of cash.
So just to preserve value, then?
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time to answer my question.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. You know, the other thing that Peter points out, Hemant, is that anytime you have an inflationary boom, you're going to have a deflationary bust. And so by holding physical bullion, to the extent that you are looking to buy things that were fueled
correct.
By credit and are now going to be dropping in price, such as houses, you want to be in real cash because you're going to have effectively a deflation in credit-based assets and a preservation in hard assets like gold.
Absolutely. I mean, you look back at the 30s, I mean, what happened there in a deflationary climate? You got the two premier names in gold and gold mining, which were Homestake Mines and Dome Minerals, both the U.S. and the Canadian companies that were the preeminent ways to play gold at the time. And they rose eightfold, ninefold. This is in a period where average investors got no returns with a deflationary climate. And so anybody who had the exposure to gold in that manner did very well because their purchasing power was increasing.
Correct, correct. Let's go to Meyer in California. Meyer, thank you so much for patiently waiting on the air. You are with Hemanth Kathuria and Neeraj Chaudhary, substituting for Peter Schiff on Wall Street Unspun.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Where are you in California?
Great. I live in Westwood. I'm a student at UCLA.
Oh, welcome to the show. You're right down the street from us. We're in Brentwood.
Yes, great. All right, my question is my roommate is a foreign exchange student from Norway, and we discuss economics frequently. And being that Norway has a socialist government with a government spending at 41% of the GDP, and the Economic Freedom Index rates at number 37 below Uruguay and Botswana. Yet Norway has the wealthiest citizens on earth. It owns a large sovereign wealth fund. It has a strong currency, and it maintains the highest per capita foreign reserves than from any other nation. And I've heard Peter a number of times recommend investing in Norway. So what is Norway doing right? Is it merely that their vast resources divided by their small population in the short run allows for the inefficient mining? Because it seems like they should be farther down the road to serfdom than we are.
You know something? That's exactly what you said is 100% right. I couldn't have said it any better myself. I was waiting for you to finish talking about Norway and the percent of government spending and the Economic Freedom Index, and I was going to tell you that the Norwegians are wealthy in spite of government invention, not because of it. Without all that government invention, the Norwegians would be even wealthier. It's a very small population. What is it, Hemanth, about 5 or 6 million people?
Yes, and you hit the nail on the head with the per capita reserves being the highest on Earth. You've got a large, vast amount of resources over a small population. Now, you have those same characteristics, of course, in Canada and Australia and New Zealand, but the situation in Norway is that they are directly benefiting because oil is the is the most sensitive sensitivity to the printing of dollars that's going on here. I mean, you got 82 million barrels a day, which disappears. It's gone forever, and that oil is priced in dollars, and the supply of dollars is increasing dramatically, constantly. It's a secular move. It's a something that will not stop, and so every barrel of that oil becomes more and more precious, and so that is the ultimate backstop in making Norway wealthier and wealthier, and so they are able to afford to have that type of an economy where they can offer a lot to the citizens.
Okay.
But effectively, you've got to remember again, as always, you know, the government does not create any of that wealth. It's not that the government stepped in and somehow magically found capital reserves somewhere and then is holding them in the form of the sovereign wealth fund, on behalf of its people. The only way that the government can acquire any resources is by taxing the private sector. That's the key thing that I think I was a student. That's what I would remind people if I was if I was in class. Remind people that the government doesn't create anything. That's the key to the whole equation. Hemanth, I'm informed by our control room that Peter is now on the air. Peter, welcome.
Thanks, guys. You know, I hear you talk about Norway. You know, I've actually got quite a big following out in Norway. And one of the volunteers that's working on the Shift for Senate campaign is a Norwegian who came all the way from Norway to volunteer and work on my campaign. So, and there's a lot of people in Norway who are against a lot of the big government policies and the nanny state that exists in Norway. And it's quite...
Sure, I looked at a chart going back to 2004, and that currency still is relatively stable. I think there's a lot of upside there. You know,
I think what's happening, too, I think look around the world. There was a huge move up yesterday in the Singapore dollar. I think it was up 1.5%. And the Singapore government actually came out and stated that, you know, the currency, because their GDP numbers came out really strong, I think up like 9%. We got really strong numbers coming out of South Korea. China, I think, is reporting numbers overnight. They're going to be really strong for their GDP. There's got to be a move coming in the Chinese RMB. I mean, some type of move to revalue that currency, to let that currency go up. And, of course, once that happens, that will, you know, allow a lot of currencies throughout Asia to rise, and that will put a lot more pressure on the dollar. I mean, the dollar has held up recently because of all the problems that people perceive to exist in Europe. And there certainly are problems there, but I think that the problems are still smaller than they are in the United States. But meanwhile, the dollar index, again, continues to move sideways. It's right back down. You know, it tried to break out a little bit. It got up close to 82. It's back down to just about 80 again. I think if we close below 79.50 or 79, I think we'll really put in a top in the dollar index. And I would not be surprised if we move down very quickly once we broke through that pattern. And once the focus is off the problems in Europe and back on the problems in the U.S., which I think, you know, are just getting much, much worse. I mean, sure, the U.S. economy, as measured by GDP, is expanding. You know, we got news today the trade deficit grew by more than expected. We're still getting higher retail sales. All we're doing is repeating the mistakes that led to the crisis. We're spending more borrowed money. We're growing our GDP based on consumer debt, based on government debt, all the while the real wealth-producing part of the U.S. economy continues to disintegrate. And all we do is go deeper into debt to consume what the rest of the world produces, and we are on the verge of a much bigger collapse once the dollar resumes its descent.
Hey, Jim Chanos has gotten a lot of attention in the United States the last few days, going around talking about a bubble in Chinese property. Given the fact that you just got back from China, why don't you tell us about your experiences there and kind of what's happening with the strength and the dynamism over there?
Well, I don't think, first of all, in order to buy a house in China, you need a 40% down payment to buy a house. And if it's a second house, then you need a 50% down payment. So the amount of money that you have to put down is enormous. And there's also rules that on how quickly you can turn around and sell a property. I mean, you can't, I mean, there's rules against flipping. So you can't just buy a property and turn around and sell it. So you don't have that tight dynamic. Obviously, there's no subprime market. There's no stated income mortgages. The lending standards are so much stricter in China than they are in the United States. And I do think that property prices in China are responding to a highly inflationary policy, monetary policy, being pursued by the Chinese in order to prop up the value of the U.S. dollar. And so prices are rising in China, and, you know, it would be much better if prices were falling, which is what they would be doing. But instead of prices falling, the value of their money is falling because they've pegged it to the dollar. And so prices have to rise. I mean, it's just there's nothing they can do but rise. Now, I do think that there is a danger of if China pursues this policy for too much longer, that they will inflate more dangerous bubbles that will burst. But I believe that they will do the right thing before that point is reached. But certainly the Chinese economy would be in even better shape if they had their own monetary policy, if they weren't importing our monetary policy, if they had a freely floating exchange rate and the RMB was allowed to rise, if the Chinese government wasn't, you know, accumulating these massive sovereign wealth funds and foreign currency reserves. China now has over $2.5 trillion in reserves, not all of which are dollars. But that equates to something like $1,500 for every man, woman, and child in China. That's a lot of money. You know, I'm sure the Chinese could make much better use of that money other than holding them in low-yielding U.S. treasuries.
Yeah, very true. Let me ask you another question. How's the campaign going? I read in last week's Connecticut paper that you got a very nice write-up, a lot of excitement about the campaign. How are things going in the campaign?
Well, I think they're going well. I mean, I don't, you know, we'll see when the next poll comes out of the Republican primary, but I'm doing a lot of events. That's why I couldn't do the show. You know, doing this week is really, really busy. Of course, I was out of the country for a week, so I wasn't able to do anything, so I'm kind of making up for that. But I think it's going well. You know, I just was looking on the internet. I noticed that Ben Bernanke was speaking today and came out and said that, you know, inflation is totally in check. It's nowhere in sight. We don't have to worry about inflation. Remember, this is the same guy that said that we don't have to worry about the mortgage market, that subprime was contained, right? Well, I think his foresight on inflation is no better than his foresight on the mortgage problem. I mean, inflation, you know, and people try to pretend that, oh, well, Schiff is wrong. Look, he's been predicting inflation, and look, it hasn't happened. I mean, it doesn't necessarily, the effects of inflation aren't seen immediately. You know, sometimes it takes a while. You know, you can smoke cigarettes. You don't get cancer, you know, from your first cigarette. You know, you got to smoke for a while before the cancer develops. Now, it's not going to take that long between the lag between creating inflation and prices going up, but it's going to happen. But to try to say that, well, I'm wrong on inflation because we haven't seen the results of it yet is extremely short-sighted, and only people who don't understand inflation could possibly make those observations.
Yeah, people don't realize that the whole plan of the Bernanke Fed is to try and reinflate the bubble in the U.S. economy in the place of real production and real savings that's taking place. And that game
well,
is rapidly
they're
coming
not
going to
do
end.
It. There's too many holes. And the only bubble that they're inflating now is the government bubble. And,
correct.
You know, that's not nearly as fun as the housing bubble or the stock market bubble, because the only beneficiaries of the government bubble are people who are getting paychecks from the government or people on Wall Street that are direct recipients of government bailout money or cheap money from the Fed. But the real economy is going to suffocate. It's going to collapse beneath the weight of that government bubble. And eventually that government bubble will pop because there won't be enough life in the private sector for the government to suck out to sustain itself.
Right. Peter, we've got about 45 seconds. We've got about 45 seconds left in the show. What's your outlook for the next couple of weeks? What are you looking at? What events are going to be filling your calendar
I'm looking at the dollar. I'm looking at is the dollar topping out? Is what we're seeing in Asia the beginning of the end of this dollar rally and the resumption of the major long-term decline? And what will that effect be on interest rates in the U.S. economy? Anyway, we have some more time. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Sadly, Peter, I think you're right. Everyone, thank you very much. Hemant?
Yes.
Signing off. Thank you for joining us. Got to run. Peter Schiff, Hemant Kathuria, I'm Neeraj Chaudhary. We will see you next week. Thank you for joining.